about it. And the fact that the surface is some number of feet thick of ice suggests that the surface is pretty cold. However, I wonder what is the evidence that there is liquid water below. The fact that there are geysers, I guess, is a pretty strong piece of evidence. So maybe the liquid water below is warm enough for life as we know it to have formed. It's got its own local Goldilocks zone. And by the way, if the if Jupiter has such a strong Van Allen belt, that in order to protect Juno, you have this 1-inch thick titanium box to protect the electronics with gold plating. So how are those astronauts being protected in that movie when they go to Europa from the radiation? Jupiter is a super strong radiation source. But any idea? I guess the geysers are the main thing that gave them evidence that there must be liquid water below the surface. And if that water is, let's say, a mile thick, it's been there for a long time, ever since, from our point of view, ever since Galileo saw it in his telescope, it had enough time for life to form. And to get 400 watts out of solar panels out there at Jupiter at 5.5 astronomical units, take solar panels the area of a tennis court. That's pushing the art. So tell me about the knowledge of the water below the icy surface of Europa and the possibility for life being there, Paul. WSQN, KQI.
Repeater, time out.
You've got it, Paul.
I love listening to CWM, by the way. that's my main goal for field day. I love just listening to it, or you know, even getting a chance to operate, which Limehawk is real good for. The spacecraft that took best pictures of all those planets was Galileo. And that was you know, that they didn't have solar panels. They had an RTG on that thing, so that lasted many years. So they did. You look at any of the Galileo pictures from any of the planets, it's really going to be good. And Galileo, not to be confused with the new Galileo program from European Space Agency, they're putting up their own GPS satellites. If we have them, they're going to put their own. They've been doing it now for quite a few years. They've got quite a few satellites up, and that's called Galileo. I don't get it. They could have picked a different name. But I like the Galileo mission. That was great. That had a lifetime of about 5-6 years, I guess, maybe longer. And that's the one that went up with the broken antenna. They had to get all the information back with the small gain antenna, the big one that didn't open up properly. And that was launched from a space shuttle. So you got to check out those pictures. And as far as the geysers, no, I don't think there were geysers. Let me drop it on Roper. No, definitely on Io. That's the one with all the volcanic activity. If you look at the pictures from Pioneer that went by, in the original pictures, and compare it to Voyager or even the pictures from Galileo, it doesn't look like the same planet. You know, different volcanoes have popped up here and there. Other ones have gone away. And the guys, as you're probably thinking about, that was in the news not too long ago, is probably Enceladus. That's the moon around Saturn, and that's the one with the water ice shooting out of the moon, and, you know, adding to the rings, I guess. That's probably the one. So, and there's another one with guys that Voyager took a picture of them. Let me drop it. Not Voyager 1, but Voyager 1 has got as far as Saturn and Moon Titan, and took off on a 35-degree angle away from almost a 40-degree angle off the ecliptic plane. But Voyager 2 kept going and went to visit Uranus and then on to Neptune. And when it got to Triton, not Titan, but Triton, that was a retrograde. Jade moon, by the way. It took pictures of that moon, and it had geysers coming off it. They figured out it was geysers were made of nitrogen. Dark streaks were coming off the surface. That's what I remember about my distant past. Space mission, Dick. Got it back to you. This is WS Collect.
2 a.m.
Bridge recognized. Get you in a second. Now, getting back to Europa, Paul. What do we know about Europa? Has anything been squirting out of the surface? I think on an icy surface. I believe it's got lots of liquid water underneath that icy surface. What evidence is there of that water? How did they come to that conclusion? And if there is the Europa Clipper going to go there in the future, the idea of what they're proposing to do to do a further study of Europa. So tell us, I know it's a little bit repetitive, I've forgotten some of the things you've told me. So tell us what we've got and what we have to expect on Europa Pole. WS2N, K2LIW.
No geysers on Europa that I know of. There's cracks all over the surface, around throughout the whole planet. Probably ice pushing against other ice, creating these, some cracks. Some are like, some parts that go above the surface, but they're all over. And they're thinking about, they're guessing it's many kilometers thick, so I don't know how you're going to get through all this ice, but they're thinking possibly through some of these cracks that keep occurring. And, the scientific studies of the moon, based on certain knowledge, I forgot how they did it, certain information that comes back, I don't know if it was the orbits, they're able to determine that the inside of this thing is, it's not one big ice ball. They know that it only goes down a couple of kilometers, kind of deep, but below that, they're pretty sure that it has, filled with water. And on top of that, they know that there's rock down there, and, salty rock. They need those ingredients to possibly have some kind of life down there. So the idea is to drill through all of this, or go through one of the crevices, and somehow, eventually, get into it, and maybe even get some kind of submersible thing, some submarine type of thing floating around in there, sending signals back up to the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay. In a few minutes, I'm going to be asking you, Paul, to give us a brief report as to what you saw during the field day operation you went to. Then I'm going to be asking John, KC2WGB, as to what field day operations he may have visited on Staten Island and what took place there. I'll give a little bit of report of mine. I'll turn it over to the group for them to tell us what they saw during field day. Now, Rich just signed in. Sounds like he's got a space report question for you, Paul. N2EO, with your space report question, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Dick, I asked a question earlier, but so I took a nap. So I'm waiting for next week. I want to know, because he sent me an email, astronauts and spirituality. So I want to say thank you. The other thing I wanted to know, they wanted to kill Galileo, preparing to say that we were not the center of the universe. Is it you people or somebody else? Why did they kill him? Did they just excommunicate him back to that and to him?
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to John and Paul in that order for a comment, but my recollection was that they got Galileo to recant, to say that, no, I'm not seeing pockmarks on the moon, I didn't see those moons going around Jupiter. He was under house arrest for the rest of his life, and rather than die, they talked him into retracting his statements in Theory. That's your job, you have to say. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Exactly right, Dick. The ecclesiastical court gave him mercy and just locked him at house arrest for the rest of his life. Whether or not he served the entire time, I'm not sure. But I know he did recant his statements. He just pacified him, said, you know, whatever you want to believe. And then he backed off. But he knew he was right. But you got it. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, maybe you want to add to the Galileo story, you know, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I think that's pretty much the way I've heard it. I've seen so many stories, and I know Carl Sagan has written many, many stories about these past people and the problems that they had. That's probably about right. You know who also knows the history of this stuff? All these people. Craig, he does the astronomy net, and Tuesday nights. Well, it's not every Tuesday, but he comes up with these people that I've forgotten about for years and years. I'll tell you a story about them. Pretty good at remembering the history of that. So, Rich, you could always check in with into the astronomy net. And, you were asking about field day. Yeah, I went to two field days. I usually try to get to the Great South Bay. Didn't make it there last year, but this year I made it. And I wonder if that yellow tape was still up when you were there, Dick. You couldn't really go near any of the tables. I couldn't even see the radios that they had, you know. They had everything blocked off. I don't know why they had that. So, and of course, we always go over to Limehouse. I saw Andy there, WHUCDO, and a nice talk with him, a couple of the other guys. And I quickly find my way to the CW tent just to even listen. And then eventually we got the transmit. And to me, that's what field day is about. You know, everybody likes their favorite modes, and that's mine. You know, we'll do microphone or whatever, you know, there's a radio open. But I couldn't spend much time.
With repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You, Dick, this is WS2N.
And one of the things that you really appreciate is field day CW reception. As you probably remember, Mel K2KEY of the TechNet in the old days, now a silent key. Very frequently he would go to sleep listening to Morse code. It really calmed him. He liked to listen to it. But while I was at Gizbox, and yes, the yellow tape was there, but the people were periodically lifting it and going there. The yellow tape was to give you warning you're about to walk near feed lines and guy wires and stuff like that. I had a nice conversation for an hour and a half, 2 hours with Fred Krueger, K2LDC. And Fred Krueger, during his flight instruction as a pilot, he had to demonstrate his instrument capability. Instrumentation, non-visual flight rule capability under the hood. And so instructor instructed him to go to a particular VOR station on Long Island. Go to the right frequency, find that station. And Fred did that. And then Fred was listening to the Morse code of the VOR station, CCC, dotted, 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 dotted. And the instructor said, hey, you didn't do it right. If you went to the right frequency, how do you know you really got the local VOR station? You didn't check it on the chart. Which Fred said, I didn't have to. I heard the Morse code identification. I'm a Morse code cop here. Lots of pilots apparently don't know the Morse code. They have to go to the chart, to dash dot, dash dot, to know what the Morse code is doing. And Fred said, I don't need the chart. I'm copying the Morse code directly. So, ham radio operators as a pilot have got this advantage. Okay. John, KC2WGB, what was the field day like at Staten Island? Did you have a chance to visit any of them? How many of them? How big were the operations? And what...
Repeater, timeout.
As I was starting to say, what was it like in Richmond County, New York City, Staten Island? KC2WGB, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, I know they set up and they had a pretty good response. I didn't visit, I didn't have a chance to do that, so I really have no information, Dick. But I'm sure everybody had a nice time, they usually do.
Yeah, it's the high holy days of ham radio. Quite a few guys really look forward to getting away from the family for 24 or so solid hours. Some of those people stay up around the clock. I did, just to visit these guys and get into some pretty wild conversations from time to time. And we discussed the cabbages and kings and high-power radio and biology and astronomy. Oh, boy, there's all kinds of subjects. Of the guys within the sound of my voice that I haven't put to sleep already, you visited or were part of a field day operation. Just give us your call letters right now. I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit from your point of view what you saw. So, field day operators, field day observers, give me your call letters right now. K2IW in the TechNet.
AG2RY.
Dave recognized. Anyone else? Sounds like I put the rest of them to sleep. The guys who get really serious with field day spend a lot of waking hours. By now, they're trying to catch up on their sleep so they can go to work tomorrow. Maybe you're one of those lucky guys that doesn't have to go to work tomorrow, Dave. KG2RY. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KG2RY. You know, the astronomy net is like the best thing. You know, Ken, just listen to it. You know, it's like poetry for me anyway. I was staying at Airbnb nearby Flushing Corona Park, and I witnessed the Hall of Science field day group at Flushing Corona Park. It was sort of out in the back behind the museum, and there's about maybe 8 or 10 people there. There were two working radios. Two antennas, one for 40 meters, one for 20 and 15. And 40 meters was getting a lot more activity at this particular location. And I operated for about 2 hours on 20 meters and 15 meters. And I got maybe about 8 or 9 contacts, not too far away. Signals were hard to read, but somehow I was able to get the information down. So it was just a lot of fun. Everybody was having a good time. Everybody's very friendly and very welcoming to a stranger. Just basically walked in. Back to you, K2RIW, KG2RY.
Who was that? Please give me your call letters again.
This is AC2IS, Bill.
AC2IS, Bill. The guy who has written documents about programming in Baofeng and Roxon programmed my radio for me while I was there. And I made the mistake of sticking it in my pocket and breaking the antenna. The rubber duct coming out of the Baofeng is pretty easy to break, but they are repairable. So I think you spent a good deal of time at the Great South Bay. Let me think, is that where I saw you? Yeah, I saw you at Great South Bay. Let me think now. Was it Great South Bay? Yes, it was. So, give us your impression of that great big operation of Great South Bay, Bill. AC2IS. It's a beautiful sounding RF these days. This is new, well installed antenna. K2IW and TechNet. You got it, Bill.
Hey, yeah, so my experience at field day was that there's a guy there named Dick Nadel who was fielding some interesting questions about an antenna that was being used for tracking satellites, something about multiple antennas and having to do, I think, impedance matching between the pair of antennas. Let's see, I don't know, I only started listening at around 9, so I don't know if you covered that earlier, but I thought that might be interesting for other people to hear about. AC2IS.
Yeah, very fine, Bill. It all got started a few days ago. I got a call from, boy, mine's going blank, guy who lives in Massachusetts. I'll think of him in a minute. QGZ, the major QGZ, Bill Fastenow, have this Cushcraft cross-polarized Yagi thing that's intended for satellite operation. And there was a very spooky hookup of the horizontal and vertical elements of this Yagi going into a T connector, and the impedance matching and the phase shifting in order to make clean circular polarization for Oscar satellite reception, satellite ham radio satellite reception, was the question. And as I was at the Gizbox setup, you, Bill, I'm so forgetful, Bill, tell me the call letters of the other people at Gizbox that had worked on that antenna. And one of those guys talked to Kushcraft directly, or went to websites, I'm not sure, to try to get the instructions for the proper tuning, alignment, and setup of that antenna. And he found not one, but three sets of instructions. And they all conflict with each other as to how to hook it up to satellite operation. Let me drop. In order to make circular polarization, you've got some horizontal polarized elements, some vertically polarized elements, and if you feed the two sets of elements the exact same amount of power, but 90 degrees out of phase, so if the signal starts off polarization-wise at 12 o'clock and proceeds towards 3 o'clock, an antenna that does that, when viewed in the direction of propagation with the back of the antenna in your chest, the IEEE calls that clockwise circular polarization. So conveniently, usually you would set up with a 3 o'clock polarization antenna, a quarter wavelength long coaxial cable, giving 90 degrees delay, making the circular polarization. Okay, here's the problem. This particular Kushcraft antenna did it on the cheap, where they should have been using a power divider to take the main transmission line into the antenna and then divide the signal into two 50 ohm outputs, equal power from a power divider or a quadrature hybrid, and then the right length of 50 ohm cable going into the horizontal and vertical elements, that would all come out right. They use a simple T connector. Okay. The first part probably be got with a T connector. They bring two 50 ohm coax cables into it. They combine in the T connector and make 25 ohms. That's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Well, you can get around that problem by aligning each gamma match rod of each antenna so that each is a 50 ohm load. Then if you're using a quarter wavelength of 70 ohm cable from each antenna into the T connector, the 50 ohms of each antenna, quarter wave of 70 ohm cable, becomes a 100 ohm load at the other end of that cable. Combine a pair of 100 ohm loads at the T connector, that gives you now 50 ohms, everything comes out hunky-dory. There's a catch. You want each antenna to be fed with a quarter wavelength of 70 ohm cable. Well, if you did that, the two antennas are now identical in phase shift. Combine a horizontal and vertical in phase, you've got a very expensive way of generating slant 45 degree polarization, no circular polarization at all. And now you try to make one of those cables 90 degrees further in length in order to get the phase shift, now that that impedance matching goes out the window. So various techniques were tried, conflicting techniques on the three separate sets of instructions. I'm not sure I have faith in any of them. And so some guesses were done by Bill and others, Bill Fastenau of QGZ, and I'm not sure if Bill at AC2IS was also involved in this operation. And when I get that turned over to him, he's going to give us the call letters of the other people that attempted to make this. So they took a stab at it. They did make some satellite reception, so they got good operation. But when you do generate a pure circular polarized pair of Yagis at right angles, and you try to confirm it's got good circular polarization, one way to do it is to make the axial ratio test. Let me try. You take a linear polarized antenna like a dipole, hold it in front of that Yagi while it's transmitting, slowly rotate the dipole in polarization, and if you can rotate it 180 or 360 degrees and say equal amplitude with no nulls, you've now got circular polarization. But there's a big catch. Most likely you're going to be doing that over ground. So you get a direct signal going to the test antenna, you get a reflection signal going off the ground, a clockwise signal going to the direct antenna, direct path to the antenna, test antenna is great. The signal bouncing off the ground clockwise becomes counterclockwise, that they were equal in amplitude, combined clockwise and counterclockwise, generating linear. So the environment in which you try to test circular polarization, that's a severe test. You can't tolerate any ground reflection. So now you've got to aim the antenna on the test, the CP antenna, straight up in the air, and it becomes difficult. So confirming CP, so difficult that you're way ahead of the game of knowing the impedance of the horizontal and vertical antenna, knowing the impedance matching and the length of the cable feeding each, and in other words, mathematically, you make a leap of faith and say, hey, I've done it right, it's going to be CP. Confirming the CP is so difficult. So, Bill, what were the call letters of the other guys at Gizbach that were involved with the experiments and attempts to make that satellite circular polarized Yagi antenna? I think it was 10 elements horizontal, 10 elements vertical, something like that. What were the call letters of the other guys involved with that operation, Bill? AC2IS, KC2R, K2RIW.
My apologies, Dick. I'm terrible with names and even worse with call signs. So I don't think I'm going to be able to relay that information. I know that the guy that you were talking to at the table there is a longtime Gizbach member. But it's been a while since I've spent much time at Gizbach, so all these details have faded. My apologies. AC2IS.
So we owe Dick with Simmons.
Okay, Rich recognized. And 2EO, maybe you're familiar with that Cushcraft cross-polarized Yagi thing. Go ahead, Rich. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You know, I'm very close friendship with Barry at 2MB. When he was on Oscar 10 and Oscar 13, which are Mylania or satellites, found the circularly polarized antennas not really necessary. But he used in the end was a 16 element, believe it's at times, KLF. They just put it out of time. Got so much gain. Satellite would tumble, go, you know, to the point of the storm. It was still very powerful. That's what he found best thing. I used to go over to his Rockaway. Wonderful.
Yes, some of the satellites and some of the spacecraft use circular polarization. Apollo spacecraft use circular polarization. So you're going to be wasting a lot of potential signal strength. You're not receiving those signals with circular polarization. I think one or two of the amateur satellites did use circular polarization on the satellite. A good number of them, and maybe the most recent one, is using linear polarization on the satellite. Well, the satellite is tumbling in space. Therefore, if you're using a linear antenna on the satellite and a linear antenna on the ground, as the satellite tumbles, you're going to be getting some pretty deep fades. So if your antenna during the reception is circular polarized, as the satellite tumbles, you don't see any fades. That's one approach. And so apparently what Barry was doing is the brute force approach, lots of gain, such that even during the phase, he's still above threshold and he's hearing the satellite. Every linear polarized antenna is never purely linear. There's always a little bit of CP left. So if you've got enough extra gain, although you're going to be seeing some QSB, you're still getting some darn good solid reception during the tumbling of the satellite. When it comes to antenna engineers, let me drop this. Antenna engineers with 10 or 20 years of experience, I think only 5 or 10% of them have a warm, fuzzy feeling about the science of circular polarization of antennas, design, use, tuning, whatever, circular polarization. Antennas in general are a mystery to the average electronic engineer. Take average electronic engineers with RF as their major. Because of the way it's taught in schools, less than 10% of them feel comfortable on the subject of antennas until they're in the field with 10 years of apprenticeship or more, in order for them to feel comfortable with real antenna design. Among those those antenna design engineers that survived that apprenticeship program. I think only 5 or 10% of those guys have a warm, fuzzy feeling about circular polarization. So the art and science of circular polarized antenna design. We're talking about the creme de la creme here. I mean, you know, the small percentage of the small percentage of people who go down that road. And of all the people that I've ever interviewed, my 35 years of experience at AIO and another 10 years of experience as a consultant, of all the potential RF engineers that were applying for whatever company I was working for, that I've interviewed, let me drop this. A high percentage of them, when I asked them the question of all the courses you've taught, studied in college, which course did you like the least? About 50% of them would say that Don Fields and Waves course, that Don course on Maxwell's equation, or that gave me a lot of grief. So the way they teach RF antenna design, by way of Maxwell's equation, so by modern day techniques, very far off target is one possible opinion, unless you're a very academic person. Of all the people I've ever talked to on that subject, I met one human being at AIO who really loved the Fields and Waves course. And I asked this lady and the engineer, why in the world did you like that course when so many other people didn't like it? She said, I'm a math major, and that three-dimensional matrix mathematics really enthralled me. So the mathematics that was involved in the Fields and Waves or Maxwell equation course, I loved the math. Didn't understand what it meant and how they were using it. I just liked the math. So she liked that course for a left-handed reason. We dropped it. So do know that circular polarization is a bit of a conundrum. There's the Antenna Engineering Handbook. Each one of them has a chapter discussing circular polarization, giving you some nice diagrams, some nice charts, allowing you by various means to calculate the circular polarization purity, which is called the axial ratio test. So there are, on circular polarization, there is a fair amount of good data. Now, Antenna Engineering Handbook, all four editions of it. The book by Scientific Atlanta on antennas. Let me think, I'm trying to think of some of the other antenna books I know. Of the 30 or 40 antenna books I own, I'm trying to think of the ones that have got pretty nice chapters on CP. So, for those who are interested, if you Google the word circular polarization of antennas, guarantee Google will supply you a lot of websites. Let me drop this.
Question, WS1.
Be with me in a minute, Paul. There are lots of websites that will give you lots of good information on it. There's another point they're going to make about Google circular polarization. Oh, yeah. Don't forget that there's a huge difference of opinion between the people who understand physics and the electrical engineering world. The IEEE has a definition of circular polarization that, in theory, all electronic engineers under IEEE standards know what clockwise circular polarization is. You talk to a person who's using basic physics, a physics major, tell him what the IEEE calls clockwise, he says, oh, you guys are crazy, that is counterclockwise. The chances are the guy in physics is more right. You take the definition of a
repeater, timeout.
You take the definition of a clockwise wave by IEEE standards and really study what that wave looks like when it's in space. It looks like a Mobius strip that's twisted, and it's a counterclockwise twisted corkscrew. The clockwise IEEE defined wave, defined from the point of view of ease of hooking up the cables to the antenna to make it come out what IEEE calls clockwise. That wave, when transmitted by that antenna, is a left-handed corkscrew in space. So those basic physics guys, they may be more right. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I just was wondering which antenna you were talking about at Great South Bay. Is that the one, you know, the one that you're talking about, circular polarization? is that the setup that they had with the LL? You know, you first walk in, and they had an actually was two antennas mounted on this thing. I didn't see it move though, but you know, I guess they weren't using it yet. I wonder, is that the antenna you're talking about that they were making CP?
Yeah, that first yellow tape marked up area near the left hand side, there was a pole that went up, I'm going to pick a number, 25 feet, with an LAS antenna positioner on top of it. And one of those antennas is a cross polarized Yagi. A Yagi with something like 10 horizontal elements and 10 vertical elements, all mounted on the same boom. Two separate feed lines coming off those two separate gamma-fed driven elements, and those two feed lines went into a T-connector, came down to the common transmission line going to that antenna. So that was the CP antenna on top of that pole. When you're standing at the food area and looking into the field, on the left-hand side is where this thing was mounted, the pole, WS2N, P2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, okay. I was looking at the LL, trying to figure out if it was the AZ or not. It looked like a brand new setup, but very nice. But so you're saying there were two antennas, so just using the two antennas at the same time, that's what was making this a circular polarization, not like it's just one, you know. I remember the helical antennas, that would create a circular polarization all by itself, right? So this was two antennas doing the same job, is that right?
Way back in the early days of Oscar satellites, a man in Hawaii, Katani Nose, had a simplified technique where two separate Yagis spaced horizontally, but both aimed in the same direction, one horizontal, one vertical, or one slant 45 right, one slant 45 left. He would feed these two separate Yagis with horizontal spacing, just right, aim that thing with an Azel positioner, and make circular polarization. That's one technique. The antenna in question at Gizmok that we're talking about is one single boom with a bunch of horizontal elements on that boom, or a bunch of vertical elements on that same boom. So when you look at this in front view, it looks like a plus sign, that Yagi. So that's the Yagi we're talking about. The instructions were very spooky, three sets of instructions, no clear way as to how to hook it up to make good, clean, circular polarization out of it, because it was doing power dividing. Let me drop it. It was doing power dividing with a very simple T-connector, type N T-connector. The right way to do the power dividing, to make CP on a cross-polarized Yagi setup, is with a real 50 ohm in, 50 ohm out, 2-to-1 power divider, or a quadrature hybrid type of power divider. It's the right way to do it. But this Cushcraft thing did it on the cheap, and three conflicting sets of instructions as to how to set it up, and a fair amount of confusion. And the way they did set it up, they were getting something like a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio out of it. The transmitter they were using was capable of 50 watts of output, was cutting back in power because of the VISWA, but they still managed to make a satellite QSO with it, and therefore they got the 1,000 points bonus ball. So that's the antenna we're talking about right now, the questionable Cushcraft Yagi cross polarized on one boom. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. A picture's worth 1,000 words. Very good. Now I know what we're talking about anyway. Very good. Back to you, Dick.
Amen. Person who said comment, please start off with your call letters, your name, and then proceed with the comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is Mike number 2, K1MJM. I have, at the Discovery Museum in Bridgeport, I have a set of circular polarized antennas. They are M2 or M squared antennas. They're very well made, very nice. They have dividers, and there's no question as to how to hook them up. Their instructions are very clean. So if you're ever interested in seeing how they do it, they have a very nice instruction sheet on online. Back over to you, K1MJM, I'm clear.
Very funny, Mike number two, who has the website called LimonTechNet.com with lots of extra information and supporters of the technical net. So, there are people out there making clean, circular polarized antennas with good sets of instructions. I'm making sure that my buttons are pressed here on my Kenwood TS711A. If I don't have this button pressed in, I sound like that. You don't hear much. If I press that button, which is called the speech processor, you got a very nice speech processor in this rig. I've got a lot of love for this oldie but goodie Kenwood TS711A. 2 meter, all mode, completely variable power output by way of the knob on the front panel. The cleanest synthesizer you've ever heard. Very clean sideband, very clean FM. Nice rig, 1990 vintage, it's oldie but goodie, only got 30 memories. But it's got its own built-in 110-volt power supply. You can feed it 110-volt AC, or feed it 12 volts, and it's happy. It's a base station rig, a little bit on the bulky side as far as mobile operations are concerned. Only puts out 25 or 30 watts. But for a lot of VHF transverter operations, let me drop it. That's more than enough power to operate them. A 1296, a 2 gig, 3 gig, 10 gig transverter. The fact that you get completely variable power output from 1 watt to 30 watts on the front panel means you can easily select just the right amount of drive power for your transverter. Very clean sideband, a synthesizer that moves in 10 hertz steps, one of the cleanest synthesizers you've ever seen. Very nice design. And when it comes to how they make that phase lock loop that good, study that schematic diagram, you realize that Kenwood put a lot of effort into that phase lock loop of that rig. It's on the used market. You can buy a Kenwood 711A, you know, I'm way off on the subject, for around $300 or so. A modern day equivalent of a 2 meter all mode rig is more like $1,500. As long as you're willing to use something that's a few years old, $200 or $300 will get you almost all of that performance. It even has built-in DCS, which I've never used, and a number of other functions, IF shiftable, IF, so on, RIT, I think of some of the other things it's got some good functions. Okay, we're getting a little short on time. Anybody with any other comments, let me jump. Anyone have any comments on circular polarization, satellite reception, field day operations, space, and radio, whatever? Any further brief questions in the 4 minutes we got left? Sign in right now. Sign in Mystery Desk. I'm picking up that program over to my line. K2RIW TechNet Lab, back for listening.
K2RY.
Go right ahead, Dave, and do wait for the beep, said Dave. KG2RY, K2RIW, and TechNet.
K2RIW, KG2RY. I just want to thank you and all the people that put this great net together, especially the astronomy net, like the most amazing thing. Thank you again, and have a great night, KG2RY.
One of the common denominators that I had with all of these people I've talked to at those three separate field day sites over the last 24 hours, and I did stay up around the clock to go to these field day sites for 24 hours, the common denominator on many of those discussions was how educational, radio-wise and otherwise, the subject of ham radio is, the hobby of ham radio. The equipment gives you the ability to talk to lots of people, crazy places, disparate places, you know, very many different places, very many points of view. But the quickest way to get information into a human being was a good set of pictures. The second best way is good conversations with two guys with a mutual passion, like ham radio, like
like the people who love the magic of radio want to pick each other's brain as to how to make good antennas, good feed lines, good transmitters, and good receivers, good microwave converters, what I'm trying to say, transverters, and good microwave reception. As you go higher and higher in frequency in ham radio, more and more technically oriented people that are willing to have a real red shoe. Let me drop this. And pass information to each other. You go down to the lower frequencies of HF, 20 meters, citizen band. You tend to run into people that are a little bit more appliance operators. They bought a rig to get on the air, and they discuss politics. Perfectly valid subject, but not quite as technically interesting. You want technically interesting people, you move to the higher frequencies. And the threshold, the frontier of the higher frequencies where you meet these very desirable people was the 2-meter band in 1960. It was the 432 band in 1970. 1980, maybe it was the 1296 band. 1990, for me, it was the 10 gig band. Almost everybody on 10 gig had a lot of real homebrew philosophy of life, building equipment and testing it out. The first time you radiate, first time you radiate a signal on 10 gigahertz with a wavelength of 1 inch, you set up a simple transmit-receive setup over a short distance. You wave your hand in front of the antenna, and every time your hand moves a half inch, you go from peak to valley of the multipath going on. Wave your hand rapidly, you start hearing a burr, burr, burr sound of Doppler shift coming off your hand. You listen to the water droplet reception, reflection from a rain cloud at 10 gigs. You listen to the aurora-like sound. There are things up there that are very exciting from my point of view. We've come to the end of TechNet number 1608. We'll be back next week. We're going to settle all these issues next week. You believe that? John and I and Paul will give you, we'll tell you another story. Be kind to each other. Try to enjoy this very educational hobby. Going to pass it over to John and Paul in that order. John, KC2WGB. Go easy on those guys in Staten Island. You got it, John. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Well, thank you for a great TechNet. It was very interesting tonight also, as usual. And I want to thank everybody for their questions and for participating. All goes well, and all stay healthy, eat our vegetables. We might be here next week. Same time, same repeater. Always a pleasure and a lot of fun. And enjoy the hobby. That's what we're here for. Paul, over to you, sir. KC2WGB.
Okay, have a good night, 73. And, we'll watch the Booster on Tuesday morning at 10:35 or NASA replay it. I want to see this 3.5 million pound thrust. It's unbelievable. If it was standing up, it would be 157 feet high, but I think they said 12 feet in diameter. Equivalent of 6 tons per second of fuel. We'll watch it on a Tuesday. Anybody that doesn't have the NASA app, you can get that for a tablet or, you know, put that in. And you click on it and automatically you get NASA TV. 73, WSON clear. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, oh boy. 3.5 million pounds of thrust. You say 6 tons per second of fuel consumption. Wow. However, this is a static test where the thing is tied down and it's not moving. Tremendous amounts of energy are being dissipated. A lot of force is being generated, but no work is being done. It's not moving a force through a distance. As far as the vehicle is concerned, well, you can look at it another way. Air it is moving tremendous cubic meters of air at tremendous velocity coming out of that nose. Coming out of that nozzle and moving the local air. So it's doing a lot of work by the air it's moving. I remember doing a calculation on the engine on the SR-71 airplane, which I had a little bit of an opportunity to work on at AIL, who produced a lot of the electronics that went on that plane. Each of those engines on the SR-71 produced 35,000 pounds of thrust when it's running at full afterburner at a speed of Mach 3.21. I'll go through the calculation of what that means. Each of those engines were turning out something like a quarter of a million horsepower. Convert that to watts if you want to be a metric. I seem to remember something like a quarter of a million horsepower coming out of each one of those engines. 35,000 pounds of thrust at that velocity. Boy, is that a lot of energy being consumed. Bye-bye, you all. Think big. K2RIW clear for listening.
That's like two X-15s. Each X-15 was a quarter of a million. That gives you an idea how powerful that thing was. Wow. 73-6.
What was the vehicle you're talking about, too? I missed the word for the vehicle you're talking about. Oh, go ahead.
I'm talking too fast. I keep thinking I'm going to lose the repeater. The X-15, you know. Armstrong flew it. A bunch of guys flew that. That was a quarter of a million, horsepower. They gave the rating in horsepower for the X-15 was a quarter of a million horsepower. So that's what you said for the XR Air Blackbird, right? Each engine. So that means that's like the equivalent of two X-15s.
Yeah, was the X-15 one of the early aircraft dropped from a bomber, which was doing the early experiment at breaking the sound barrier? Is that what the X-15 was, the Paul? Go ahead.
Well, they had broken the sound barrier before with the X-1 with Chuck Yeager back in, 47? But no, yeah, this is all through the 50s and actually early 60s. And they got it up to, 4,600 miles per hour. I think that was the highest speed. I think Armstrong did that and a couple of the other guys. But they were always pushing the envelope, trying to get it to a high speed. So, yeah, it was a black vehicle. It would drop from the bomber, I guess the B-52. It dropped from the wing, and then it would light up.
And that was probably a liquid-fueled engine, Paul, go ahead. And the X-15 was now doing hypervelocity, like 4,000 miles an hour at high altitude, is what I think you're saying. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. It got into rarefied air. Had some kind of thruster control, from what I understand. But, that was... I think it went up probably, 15, 20 times or something by 10 different pilots or something like that. But I know Armstrong was one of the pilots that was involved with that.
Hey, Dick, do you want to keep going or do I let the machine turn itself off?
We've done more than late enough. Time to turn the machine off. We kept you up late enough for Eric. And my guess is that you were up pretty late with the field day. KE2EJ for a final. KE2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
But I did no beep. Oh, well. I had a good day. I got a decent amount of sleep, so I got nothing to complain about. Anyway, the machine's probably going to turn us off in about another 30 seconds. KE2RIW, KE2EJ.
Thank you. Bye-bye for now.
The time is 12:07 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.